continue our conversations with the candidates on the November ballot today on Smart Talk, joining us is Ken Krawchuk, who is the Libertarian Party candidate for governor of Pennsylvania. Mr. Krawchuk, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Let's start off with a little bit of your background. What would you tell our listeners about Ken Krawchuk?
Well, I was raised in a row home in North Philadelphia. I've been married to my wife, Roberta, now for 41 years. And, you know, our kids pick on us. We have three daughters. They pick on us. They say, all of our friends' parents are divorced, separated. What's wrong with you guys? I guess he hasn't gotten tired of me yet. Professionally, I'm in information technology. I'm an entrepreneur. I also hold three United States patents related to database theory. I'm a Toastmaster, which is what gives me the ability to talk on radio shows and things like that. Plus, I'm an author. I have a novel out there, Atlas Snubbed, which is a parody sequel to Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged.
When you say a parody sequel, a lot of people are familiar with Atlas Shrugged. What's the parody sequel?
Well, it's not so much a ha-ha parody, but more a counterpoint. She is the philosophical matriarch of the Libertarian Party, but some of her ideas are simply indefensible. So after my last run for governor in 2002, I decided to take pen to hand and to present political solutions to some of the things that she left wide open. And probably the biggest piece of it is that there is an entire society built around the libertarian principle that you have the right to live your life your way, provided you respect the rights and property of others.
So, okay, that's one aspect. But you know there are some libertarians out there who do use Atlas Shrugged as, I don't know, I hate to say their Bible, but I know people who became libertarians after reading that book. What else? What else do you think that she got wrong?
Well, there's a lot of things that are outside of Atlas Shrugged. For example, she has an essay saying why a woman could never be president. I mean, that's just radical. Another thing that's criticized a lot from Atlas Shrugged is that they're very cold when it comes towards welfare or helping other people. And that's another major area that I focus on. There's a way that we can set up a parallel organization to government. It would look just like government. We have a constitution, a president, a Congress. But their goal would be to help people who by misfortune or whatever, need the help of society. And that's what I would call it, society. And it looks just like government except for one key feature. It does not have the coercive power of taxation. So all the money that they raise, they can pass a Social Security Act, but they can't garnish your wages to pay for it. They could have free public education, but they can't levy a property tax to pay for it. They just can't hold a gun to your head. And that's one of the main points of the book, the separation of society and state.
So for those who aren't familiar with the core principles of being a libertarian, I can ask this question two ways. What are those core principles, and what are your core principles?
Well, both of them are the same. We libertarians are different from the two old parties because we are the party of principle. Every law we support or oppose can be traced back to one central idea, the idea that your life is yours, that your property is yours, that you have the inalienable right to live your life your way without interference, provided only that you respect the rights and property of others. That's it, Scott. It's the golden rule on a political level, your life, your way. And when I'm out on the road, I ask people, how many believe that you have the right to live your life your way as long as you respect others? And Scott, every hand in the room goes up. We're all libertarian. And I just say it's time for people to start voting that way.
An observation that I have heard many people over the years say that basically I'm libertarian, that my beliefs follow those of libertarians. Mm-hmm. But realistically, I know a libertarian will have a very difficult time, if not impossible time, to get elected, that you have to be a Republican or a Democrat. Even libertarians, I think of Rand Paul, for example, that have had to become Republicans or join the Republican Party because it was the only way they could get elected. What do you say to people like that?
Well, I say just give them the facts. Right now, there are about 40 elected libertarians in Pennsylvania. The last number I heard is 176 nationwide. That's more than all the other third parties put together. Since our founding in 1971, we have constantly been growing to the point where we are third largest. Politically speaking, I call us the 800-pound chihuahua. And we are on our way, and we just keep growing. This isn't a sprint, Scott. It's not like Ross Perot, who's just like a flash in the pan, comes and goes. We've been around for a long time, and we continue to grow. And more people are realizing that everybody does have the right to live their life their own way as long as they respect others.
You have run for statewide office in the past. What did you learn?
What have I learned? I learned that the people are ripe for a third party. Because when I, as I mentioned just a moment ago, when I ask people, how many believe you have the right to live your own life your own way as long as you respect others? Everybody believes that. Everybody knows that the two parties are polarizing. We just have to look at Washington, what's going on nowadays. I've pledged I'm not going to say anything negative about anybody. I mean, some of their policies are pretty silly, but I'm not going to say anything negative about the people. So one thing that I learned is that people are very receptive to the libertarian message when it's presented to them. We just haven't had a chance to get it out. People like you, Scott, and WITF, you just have been very wonderful to us to get that message out.
Well, we try to treat everyone the same and get that message out no matter what party the candidate is affiliated with. Let's talk about some issues. You spoke earlier about, you know, the government can do this. They just can't take your money for that. They can't hold a gun to your head, I think is the wording you use.
Yes.
So how do we fund government if the government can't, as you called it, garnish wages?
Well, now you're looking at two different things. You're talking about the world of my novel. Now, in the real world, we have taxation. If we tried to get rid of taxation overnight, the displacement would be enormous. In my race, I call myself the death in taxes candidate, quoting Benjamin Franklin, Pennsylvania's most famous citizen, probably. My goal as governor would be to reduce death in taxes as much as possible, realizing that it can't be eliminated, whether it's death from the opioid crisis or at the hands of the police or whatever it may be. And on the taxes side, reducing the fact that Pennsylvania's taxes, the cost of government, has been rising at, on average, more than three times the rate of inflation for over 50 years. So I know I'm not going to eliminate these things entirely, but I'm going to reduce them as much as humanly possible.
When you say that the rate of government spending has increased at least three times more than the rate of inflation, the world has changed. Government is doing a lot more.
Uh-huh.
In researching before coming in and talking to you, I understand that one of the things that you'd like to do is veto all tax increases. How would you do that?
Well, it's a power given to me by the Constitution, given to the governor by the Constitution, and I would just go and say veto, because nobody is holding the line on taxes. We can't afford to keep raising taxes. I would like to see that money left in your pocket, and you decide how to spend that best. I mean, to my mind, it's an open and shut issue. I'd also use the line item veto to get rid of things that we just shouldn't be spending money on. The last number I saw, it's about $400 million a year Pennsylvania is giving to the horse racing industry. Scott, are you a fan of horse racing?
Actually, yeah, but
maybe you shouldn't vote for me then. That's ridiculous. Why are we supporting these private organizations? And there are so many of these little things, these junkets that we're doing, the special interest money. I'm just going to go down the line one after the other after the other. And I was speaking with your producer earlier today about another one of the big private junkets, the primaries. She's an independent, and I'm a libertarian. We can't vote in the primary system. Why are we taxpayers forced to pay for their beauty contest? We libertarians, we pay for our own candidate selection process. The D's and the R's should as well.
You use the horse racing industry as an example, but this is the argument for why government does fund organizations like the Horse Racing Association, is that there's jobs that are tied to that. Now, I remember back in 2004 when Pennsylvania enacted slot machine gambling, that money was supposed to go to the horse racing industry and also reduce property taxes. Mm-hmm. Well, there's some questions
yeah,
as to how
right.
successful that is, but at that time, it was said that there were 35,000 jobs in Pennsylvania's horse racing industry. So that's the thinking behind providing money like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the thinking behind money going to a lot of different causes. So you said you'd use your line item veto. You would go one by one mm-hmm. to decide. What do you say to those 35,000 people if that is actually an accurate number? I mean, government, there's a lot of arguments that the government shouldn't be holding up those jobs, but it keeps people employed.
Mm-hmm. Well, the question becomes, what is the role of government? To my mind, purpose of government is to protect the lives and property of the citizens. That's it. Anything beyond that becomes a battle among special interests, and I'm against special interests controlling the government. What I would like to see is that power returning to the people. That's why I'm supporting the Universal Charitable Credit Act, What that does is it allows you as an individual to decide where your tax dollars are going to go. You can deduct dollar for dollar contributions that you make to the horse racing industry, for example, if you'd want to do that. So you can actually pick yourself what needs to be done. Arizona has passed this law, a long time ago. And so far, over 100,000 Arizonians have donated over $50 million to almost 1,000 different charities. So what this does, if you feel something's important, if you feel that it's important that seniors get their medication, or if you feel that horse racing is important, whatever it may be, you can deduct your contributions dollar for dollar, not a tax deduction, it's a tax credit, dollar for dollar. Arizona's had a lot of luck with this, and I'm in favor of that because it returns power to the people, not to some bureaucrat or some special interest.
I should make this clear because I know someone will call me out on it. I am not advocating for or against money from the state to the horse racing industry. I'm just using that as an example.
I'm advocating against it. I would use a line item veto to get rid of it.
You have also advocated for abolishing property taxes. This is an issue that has been with Pennsylvania for a long, long time. A lot of people have talked about it. How do you abolish property taxes and what do you replace them with?
Well, Scott, the same issue came up in 2002 when I ran for governor. And at the time, they were saying we're going to have a special legislative thing to address it. And of course, we say, oh, well, that worked. Well, the plan I had now is the same as the plan I had then. I took a look at the cost of education. And I looked at, in my local Abington area, I looked at the various private schools. And leaving aside the exclusive school like the Friends schools and things like that, the average tuition was as low as $5,000, $6,000 a year, maybe $12,000, $13,000, with an average of about $9,000. Then I looked at the Abington School District budget, divided by the number of students they have. Scott, do you know how much we're paying for government education? About $20,000 a kid. If we privatize the schools, close down those Taj Mahals and place the kids with private schools, we could cut property taxes in half overnight. And that takes care of half the problem. Now, 2002, one of the things that I proposed was a huge tax reduction on marijuana, recreational marijuana. I was calling for an end to this insane war on drugs. Keep the street price the same for drugs and use that difference to fund the school and retire property taxes forever. If I had gotten elected in 2002, we would not be having this conversation today.
But you cover a couple of different issues there, but I want to go back to the private school. Just so I'm clear, are you talking about abolishing public schools as we know them?
I'm not talking about abolishing public education. The Pennsylvania Constitution mandates that
right.
the Commonwealth—
Right, that's what I was going to get to, yes.
Yeah, and I have it right here in my pocket. it's my job description, I call it. It does not say that the government should buy their own Taj Mahals. It does not say that they should run their own school districts. What it says is that it should provide for a thorough and efficient means of education. And that's it. Why can't that be the more cost-effective solution to place them with the local schools instead, private schools? Your kid would get a private school education, which is, generally speaking, much better than the government school education.
Well, no, you refer to them as Taj Mahals, but let's face it, the reality is that most school districts, many, many school districts, don't have what would be considered luxurious. Maybe some do.
No, but
let's face it, there are a lot of schools in this state. I mean, you're from the Philadelphia area. You well know that in Philadelphia, for example, lots of old school buildings, lots of students that are not getting the kind of even books, pencils, the things that they need.
Yeah. Some of them, I've visited some of them. They're essentially converted warehouses. Now, what this comes back to is that would you want to condemn your child to live in that sort of a government school? I wouldn't. If you had a choice of sending them to a private school instead, I would certainly do it. And then there's what I mentioned a few minutes ago, the Universal Charitable Credit Act. If your school needs pencils, you've got the opportunity there to pay for them. And there's a secondary thing to that, too. When you send a dollar to the government, most of that dollar vanishes into the bureaucracy. And especially if you're getting federal dollars, it's even worse if you got federal dollars coming in. You're lucky if you get a dime on the dollar back on that. So you could buy 10 times as many pencils, 10 times as many books if you did it directly. Scott, we got to get government out of this equation because, you know, when I say they're Taj Mahals, why is the Abington school costing $20,000 a kid when the other schools are costing on average less than half of that? So Taj Mahal is really a small T. It's a figurative term.
Well, then how would you make it more equitable? This is an issue that Pennsylvania has dealt with for years. Mm-hmm. How would you make it that some of those schools a few miles from Abington are, okay, maybe not spending $10,000, but that it's a little more equal, that they're getting the same kind of education mm-hmm. a few miles from Abington that they are in Abington?
Well, the issue there is when you say the same kind of education, the kind of education they're getting now is not the sort of education they should be getting. I was at an event yesterday where there's a candidate running for office who is saying, I stand against cyber schools. Scott, they're the flow of the future. Schooling is not that boxy building on the corner. There are so many other things we could and should be doing. One of them is, of course, cyber schooling, which is much less expensive, much more effective, much more targeted. Another thing I'd like to see come back are apprentice programs. For example, my father was a tool and die mechanic. He would make jet aircraft parts, super tight tolerances. If you wanted to do that today, you'd be spending $100,000 on a good education somewhere, quote unquote good. Back then, he was an apprentice. He worked for the Bud Company in Philadelphia, and the Bud Company paid him to learn. So I would like to turn back to that. Instead of running these vo-tech schools, I'd like the companies to step up and start training their own people. The pilot industry right now is clamoring for pilots. It's one of my side hobbies, to pay attention to aviation. It's at the point they should start training their own pilots. They shouldn't be relying on the government education, which obviously is not working. So all of these different schools, I'll stop calling them Taj Mahals, all these different schools, there are one size fits none. They're the old Prussian model where somebody stands in the front of the room and lectures. We should get rid of that. We should change with the times. We should go to cyber schooling. We should go to homeschooling. I'm a huge fan of homeschooling. Apprentice programs. If you're saying, how would I take over the system that we have now and make it work? Scott, I don't think anybody can do that.
So you're talking about just
redesigning the schools entirely. Flow with the times.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Our guest today is Kent Krawchuk. He's the Libertarian Party candidate for governor. We're talking about a lot of different issues. You mentioned marijuana before, mm-hmm. and I know that actually this is a tenet of the Libertarian Party, that marijuana laws, drug laws. But marijuana in particular, what would you advocate as governor?
Well, one power given to the governor by the Constitution is the power of the pardon, the power to commute sentences. Scott, we shouldn't be putting these pot smokers in prison. I mean, nobody believes a pot smoker belongs in prison. In fact, with our overcrowded prisons, it's reached the point where we're releasing murderers and rapists to make room for pot-smoking Grateful Dead fans. I mean, that's insane. Using the power of the pardon, I promise on my first day in office, I will get the ball rolling to pardon every single nonviolent drug offender, bar none. Now, if they had harmed somebody or robbed from somebody or dealt drugs to kids, they're going to stay safely in prison. But if they were just kicking back, smoking a joint, watching The Simpsons, they've got to get out of jail free card from this governor.
Okay, so go a step further. Are you talking about legalizing recreational marijuana?
I'm talking about getting government out of the drug business entirely. You could call it legalizing. I would just repeal all the laws, essentially nullify all the laws that say that you have the right to keep and bear plants.
So would this compare to, say, a Colorado or a Washington state?
Absolutely. Although I think they're overregulated. I mean, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to grow it in your backyard, just like you can brew your own beer. The difference being alcohol, of course, is a dangerous drug, where marijuana is not.
Would you use marijuana as a vehicle to tax people, to take government take some money?
You know, as a libertarian, I never met a tax that I ever liked. However, right now, there is an infinite tax on marijuana. If you're caught with a joint, you know, let's say you lent your car to your teenage son and one of his friends dropped a joint in the back seat, on the spot, a cop could steal your car. On conviction, they could take your house, your life savings, everything, just because of that. These are insane drug laws that we have now. All these assets would be forfeited, which, by the way, the governor has the power to return as well under the Constitution. These are just crazy laws. I would get rid of them all. I would just let people do it, and I wouldn't tax it. Somebody may say, well, Ken, why don't we compromise? Let's take this infinite tax and we'll get it down to the street price. I'll say, all right, I'll go for a tax reduction. I'm not going to sign any tax increase.
But at the same time, now you were talking about pardoning those who have been convicted or in jail on drug convictions, but violent criminals. At the same time, you would like to, you are proposing to eliminate parole for violent criminals. Talk about that.
Yes, sir. Commonwealth Foundation did a study a number of years ago, and they found out that 95% of all crimes are committed by only 5% of the criminals. So if we eliminated parole, keep those violent criminals in jail, Scott, we're guaranteed to reduce violent crime. I can't believe why we're letting these people out, especially after we've gotten them in through our convoluted criminal justice system. I mean, that's just insane.
But doesn't it provide a motivation for someone who is incarcerated to change their life, to truly rehabilitate, that if they know there's the possibility that they could get out early and not serve that 10 or 20-year sentence, that they turn their life around?
That's true. There's always the one-on-one cases where you look at individual cases, and we look at those on that basis. And as the governor and with the lieutenant governor who's heading up the parole board, we would look at those cases on a case-by-case basis. And I'm thinking of a buddy of mine who had some medical issues, and he wound up in prison. People like him, he shouldn't have been there. As long as he's on his medication, he's fine. So things like that, yeah, we'd look at them on a one-by-one basis.
Abortion is one of the most divisive issues in this country right now. You propose something that is different. It is unique.
Thank you.
Actually say you would defuse the abortion debate. In what way?
Yep. Well, you know, this just happened again at that event I was at yesterday morning at high school. People said, are you pro-life or pro-choice? And I just smile and I say, yes. Because we can defuse this abortion debate. I think that it has been polarized. I'm not going to say deliberately. I'm not a conspiracy person or anything like that. It's just that the fact is it is polarized. All we need to do is to make one small change to the abortion laws, and that's to allow for prenatal adoption. That means if a woman does not want her unborn child, any individual or organization can step up and adopt it. And of course, they would pay for whatever the delivery costs are. Now, the woman, through the privacy of the doctor, they could ask the woman, please bring the baby to term. We have somebody who wants it. And the woman can say yes or no. Now, that's pro-choice. But if she says yes, we've just saved a baby. That's pro-life. So we get the best of both worlds at the same time.
But that happens now. I mean, someone can, before a woman who's pregnant, can make arrangements legally to provide that the baby to adoptive parents.
Yeah, but it's not there as the law, because right now all people see is, oh, let's just get an abortion. It's cheap. Let's go do it. But it does not have the force of law behind it. What I'd like to do is institutionalize that, because there are follow-ups on that as well. Because if the woman says, let's say the woman says, no, I don't want it. A lot of would say yes, because a lot of babies are aborted for economic reasons. We're guaranteed to reduce the number of abortions. That's a good thing. But if they say no, then ask them to hold the baby long enough that it could be delivered safely. What's that, 6 or 7 months? And again, they could say yes or no. Yeah, it'd be more expensive. But we could save the baby and preserve the woman's right to choose. But let me get to the other end of it. Right now, we routinely perform embryo transplants in the animal kingdom. It wouldn't take a lot of research to use those same techniques on humans, so that if a woman doesn't want the baby, in the beginning, have a month, 2 months where you could do that transplant. People who care about the unborn could dedicate tax dollars, and we could do research to make that 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, and on the other side, save babies 7 months, 6 months, 5 months. Scott, it may take 50 years or 100 years, but I see a day coming when no unborn child need ever die.
You're talking about just like you described, with embryos being transplanted.
Yeah.
But without
the force of law, that would not happen.
But today, as you're running for governor of Pennsylvania today, you said that, okay, you may have to carry a baby for 6 or 7 months, something like that. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of women say, I don't want that. That's not pro-choice. You're not giving me a choice.
They do have the choice, because they could say no. I'm not following what you're saying. They could still say no. Scott, it's not going to stop all the abortions. It's not going to stop them all overnight today. The goal here is to preserve the woman's right to choose and save babies. We're going to preserve the right to choose and save as many babies as we can. That's what it is. If you're looking for a utopia, I'm not your candidate.
Ken Krawchuk, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Always like to have our candidates leave a message with voters. What would that be?
Well, the main thing is people say, you mentioned earlier, saying candidates don't get elected. But this year, we can elect a Libertarian. The two old parties have alienated so many voters. We're going to have a turnout this year at 30%, 35% if we're lucky. All it takes this year to secure a Libertarian victory is that for me to attract the vote of 1 out of 8 voting age Pennsylvanians. 1 out of 8 is all it takes. It's actually closer to 1 out of 9, but 1 out of 9, it doesn't rhyme. So we can get elected Libertarian this year. So be sure to tell your people, visit my website, kenk4pa.com, volunteer, and most importantly, get out to the polls on Election Day and vote Libertarian.
Ken Krawchuk is the Libertarian Party candidate for governor. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, Scott, thank you guys. And WITF, you guys rock.
Today with Paul Glover. He is the Green Party candidate for governor. Mr. Glover, welcome to the program.
Hello, Scott, and thank you.
Well, introduce yourself to the voters of Pennsylvania for those who are not familiar with Paul Glover.
I lived in Pennsylvania 13 years, came down from Ithaca, New York. I've started some 18 organizations and campaigns that model ecology and justice and grassroots economic development. I've written a half dozen books on grassroots economic power and taught at 2 universities. The Greens invited me to be the candidate for governor this year because of these initiatives, because of my understanding of how we can create an economy which makes it easy for people, middle class and lower income, and even the rich, to live in a healthy, stable society for the indefinite future, rather than using it up and throwing it away short run. So I have put forward a great variety of policy proposals which model this direction, this trajectory, and these priorities for the use of our state budget, $32 billion now. And looking forward as your next governor, pointing the people and enacting these policies.
We're going to be talking about some of these issues throughout the program, but why are you running?
Well, as a priority, among the issues, I would seek to ban fracking and end mass incarceration and vastly expand green jobs. I have a proposal called the Green Labor Administration, GLAD, GLAD, which would create 500,000 green jobs in Pennsylvania without raising taxes. That all of which would point toward the reduction of the cost of living for food and housing and health care, especially. Want to expand organic agriculture in our state. Certainly legalize marijuana. And ensure that education inspires a love of learning and creativity among the next generations.
So how is a Green Party candidate different than a Republican or a Democrat?
Well, we don't accept corporate donations or bribes, that is. So we are directly beholden to the voters rather than to lobbyists who lobby on behalf of companies which dominate our land, law, and money. Often these companies are owned significantly by foreign investors. They don't really care what happens to us or our state. They just want bigger numbers in bank accounts. And so, again, the Green Party, by not accepting corporate donations, is most directly accountable. We say that when conservatives don't conserve and liberals don't liberate, Greens become centrists because we directly address the central concerns of people in general for good food, secure housing, steady work, and health care. And I have taken initiatives in all of these arenas over the decades.
You also have been quoted as saying that the Republican Party is no longer the party of Lincoln and the Democratic Party is no longer the party of Franklin Roosevelt. Why do you say that?
Well, both of those esteemed leaders in our country's history confronted corporate domination of the economy and of law. And that process even since Franklin Roosevelt's time, when he said the corporations hate me, and I welcome their hatred. The domination of both Republican and Democratic parties by corporate money has made the basic interests and necessities of average Pennsylvanians less of a priority. As I say it, Republicans will often kick you off the cliff. Democrats will escort you politely over the edge. And with all respect to people who vote Republican or Democrat or identify or are registered in those parties, we think as Greens that there's a different direction to go, which is returning the ownership of land, law, and money, and job creation to communities particularly. We look forward to, in fact, an evolution beyond the middle class to what I call the mutual class, where we get ahead by getting together. And that's an old American tradition, which, in fact, was the precursor to the development of the middle class, where people created mutual aid organizations, like the Moose, the Elks, the Odd Fellows, the funny handshake people. They were, in fact, creating, they were building the hospitals, the old folks' homes, the orphanages, the sanitaria. They paid sickness and death benefits, and the members paid pennies per week. And this is, in fact, the kind of organization that I've often started. I started a local currency decades ago, traded by millions of people in Ithaca, New York. I designed paper money on my computer and convinced thousands of individuals and 500 businesses. And then I started a health cooperative. Because members paid $100 a year, and we're covered for 12 categories of common emergency anywhere in the world, the specified maximum amount. So we have a tremendous capability. We average folks that come together take control again.
You mentioned earlier that one of the things that you do support is health care for all. What a lot of candidates for Congress or the Senate would call Medicare for all. But as governor, the federal government has a whole lot to do with this. What, as governor, could you do or could the state do to make sure that everyone has health insurance, that everyone has health care insurance?
Well, I would foster the creation of regional health cooperatives. These are self-financing, member-owned and operated. It would enable the state to expand vastly medical care for all, Medicare for all, but upon the base of these cooperatives, which would keep Medicare affordable, democratic, and humane, would in fact expand the whole idea of medical care. I've been affiliated with Dr. Patch Adams, the clown doctor, whose life story was told in the movie starring Robin Williams. I have spoken at his conferences for many years and promoted this notion of the cooperative health plan, as I say, of the sort which I started in Ithaca, New York. So on that basis, the taxpayers will not be shelling out excessively for expansion of Medicaid and Medicare, but we'll be empowering and authorizing average people who step forward to take control again of the health system.
But how do you pay for that?
Recapitulate that process, which was so successful 100 years ago.
How do you pay for that? Because it's, you know, cooperative is one thing, but health care, the actual procedures, the surgeries, the examinations, all are very costly. So having a cooperative is one thing, but how do you raise enough money? How do you get enough people involved in it that it's actually something that could be paid for without taxpayer money?
I've drafted very specific plans by which this is rolled out. It's an evolutionary process, but it begins with the covering of the everyday emergencies, which we did successfully in Ithaca, New York, and then bringing in healers of all kinds, and then creating clinics. So a lot of emphasis is on preventive care, and we do have a clinic in Ithaca, New York, which provides both holistic and standard care side by side. But as it grows, as more and more people join, and I have drafted very specific evolution for this. I call it Philadelphia. I live in Philadelphia. But Philadelphia.org details how, as more people join and renew their membership, which again is starts at just $100 a year, as capable of carrying the main load for not only paying for these, as you say, very expensive procedures, but creating our own nonprofit medical infrastructure. This, again, is not something new. The United States, many communities had this 100 years ago before insurance companies pushed them aside and said, no, we're running this thing for profit. I wrote a book about the collusion in Pennsylvania between regulators, legislators, and insurers to keep the game rigged, to keep it a very profitable insider deal. And the book is titled A Crime, Not a Crisis. So if people do go to Philadelphia.org, they'll see there the very specific plan by which this is rolled out without raising taxes.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We're speaking with Paul Glover, the Green Party candidate for governor today, talking about a number of issues. You, in your past and what you have written about extensively, does talk a lot. You do talk a lot about insurance. In fact, one of your campaign promises, if I can call it that, is that you would reform the Pennsylvania Insurance Department. In what way?
Well, the governor appoints the officials and directors and executives of our major entities, our major administrations. And that would be step A to with regard to health insurance, with regard to the Public Utility Commission, with regard to all of these entities which have so much control over the regulation by which we are bound as citizens of this state, I would appoint the people who agree that this is a better direction to go and who are motivated by public service rather than a revolving door, which we see in Harrisburg so often, between regulation and industry. I would clean the house. The phrase these days is drain the swamp. But with all respect to the intelligence and dedication of so many people who are in the bureaucracies, We need to make sure that the people there are motivated foremost by public service, not by the expectation that by yielding to corporate priority and demand, they will get a job in the industry and then rotate back into regulation. That, to me, is the top priority as I am inaugurated your next governor of Pennsylvania.
But that seems as though you call into question the integrity of people who work in the insurance industry. I mean, obviously there's a reason for insurance companies out there. It's to protect people. But you seem to be calling into question their integrity.
At the top levels of the administration, in my book, A Crime, Not a Crisis, I detail and footnote the revolving door between regulation and industry. And it is legal, of course, but I question that as a benchmark of integrity. Indeed, people who are in the government are there ostensibly to provide service to the citizens of the state. And when they are in there, always looking over their shoulder at the prospect that they will be employed by the very industry they're intending to regulate, they are charged to regulate, I think that that does call into question integrity. I'm sure they are wonderful people. They have good families, friends. They do public service. But within the position they are required to serve, they are, I think, not as effectively doing so.
We're going to have to move on to some other issues. You mentioned earlier that if elected governor, you would ban fracking of natural gas. First of all, why would you do that?
Well, fracking poisons the future. Water is fundamental to all of our lives, directly and indirectly. We rely upon it for the production of food. The people who live adjacent amid the fracking fields have a whole lot to say. We have become increasingly dependent for fracking fracking to provide jobs, and we need to reverse that. And as I mentioned, I would start the Green Labor Administration to repair the damage that we in Pennsylvania over many decades, generations, have done to the natural environment, upon which all of us, businesses as well as individuals and households, rely. We need clean water, clean air, and we need clean soil to grow the food. And so fracking, we Greens and many others believe is a disaster. It gets worse and worse. During Governor Wolf's administration, 4,000 of the 10,000 fracking permits issued so far have been issued without environmental review, and they have been expedited. Current governor and the Republican contender are both advocates of fracking. And as I say, one will kick you off the cliff, the other will support you politely over the edge. With regard to fracking, I feel very strongly we need to create an energy system, a fuel system, which is healthy. And there's nothing novel about doing so. The technology is well proven and capable, even in our more cloudy state, providing ample solar, wind, of course, and the best fuel is no fuel. That is to say, energy efficiency, where we reduce to a fraction the amount of fuel needed in order to heat and cool our homes.
You also advocate for progressive taxation. How would you describe that?
Well, in our state, we would need a constitutional amendment, but the people who have a whole lot can afford to pay more. I mean, if you're really, really rich and you have a whole lot of money, much more than you could ever spend in your lifetime, while you are surrounded by enormous poverty and hunger, destitution, and environmental destruction, you could become the king of the trash heap, actually, eventually. Without paying attention to the need in our society for equity, for not equality and sameness, but fairness. And a lot of people out there work really hard, doing their best, but they're hardly able to pay rent, mortgage, food, clothes, education, certainly health care. And so progressive taxation redresses that. It just says if you've got a whole lot more, far more than you could ever spend, and you've flown around the world three times already, let's look at how you can contribute to a healthy future on behalf of your children and your grandchildren there.
I want to move on to a couple of other issues, too. You advocate for bolder union organizing. In what way?
Well, a lot of I favor unions which which strengthen the working class as a whole, not just their own niche within the working class. Over the decades, unions have demanded bigger salaries rather than more power, more ownership. And that's why they've become divided and diluted, and a lot of sweetheart deals have made it harder for unions to make the case that they are making sure that workers get what they need, what we all need, in fact. So the bolder union organizing, to me, means a solidarity among all workers, whether unionized or non-unionized, and a greater degree of ownership of companies. There are a whole lot of worker-owned businesses in our state, and without a greater degree of worker ownership, a lot of these companies just say, "Well, fed up with you, we're leaving." And that's what happened in Philadelphia. We lost 400,000 good manufacturing jobs, where people didn't need a high school education. They just went into the factory and they bought a home, raised a family, bought a car, went on vacation. And those were the heydays. But the companies just said, "Well, we're tired of you people just demanding bigger wages. We're gone." And they're off to Indonesia, Asia in general. And that's why Philadelphia fell apart in the 70s, the 80s. It's just picking itself up now, but in a way which is not equitable, which relies on gentrification and corporate domination again. I keep coming back to that theme of corporate domination. It's like, who controls your land and your law and money? They'll control your house. They'll control your cost of living. And they'll control the future of your children. So we come back to that idea again, corporate domination, and how we can take control again on local scale, and that's been my expertise for many decades.
Mr. Glover, we're almost out of time. How does a Green Party candidate win when Democrats and Republicans have so much money, they dominate the airwaves, the media? How does a Green Party candidate win?
Well, especially grateful for airtime with you and your station, and you're completely right. We have been stiff-armed, and we win by, as third parties have always, the Republican Party began as a first party with Abraham Lincoln, and the Democratic Party also. These are all these new ideas, these insurgent notions, and the people who are outliers gather their voices, and we put forward our alternatives. We put forward our solutions, not just griping, solutions. And more and more people gradually shift in that direction. Why, already some 40% of the American electorate are not registered in either Republican or Democratic parties. They're independent. They're not satisfied, and some 60%, according to a Gallup poll, want yet another political party. Here we are. And looking forward to gathering that steam, regardless of how long it takes, and inviting people to join the Green movement, the Green Party. And in fact, we are not a third party. We're the first party, as third parties often are, to put forward solutions that gradually are taken forward in the state and the national legislature. That's why slavery ended. Women have votes, Social Security, the 8-hour workday. These all began as insurgent outlier movements among third parties. And we're proud to be in that tradition.
Paul Glover is the Green Party candidate for governor. Mr. Glover, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lair.